A panther-trapping, gator-wrestling Florida man once called an area along the Loxahatchee River home. He lived as a recluse in the 1930s, but by the 1940s, he was hosting wealthy tourists from Jupiter Island on his land, including movie stars. On July 30th of 1968, he was found dead on the land that was about to make him a millionaire. This is the story of the legendary life and mysterious death of Trapper Nelson, the wild man of Loxahatchee. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark or troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight, and I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right. All right.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring historical mysteries and legendary figures of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. The Loxahatchee River is 8 miles long and runs through Martin and Palm Beach counties near the southeastern coast of Florida. Loxahatchee, from the Seminole language, meaning River of Turtles. The river is one of two in Florida that's designated a National Wild and Scenic River. It's home to many rare and endangered species, such as the manatee and wood stork. The Loxahatchee River is known as one of Florida's most unique treasures. The peaceful, slow-flowing river flows from freshwater creeks down into a brackish estuary and empties through the Jupiter Inlet into the Atlantic Ocean. Every year, tourists visit a remote area along the Loxahatchee known as Jonathan Dickinson State Park. They access the area by way of canoe and experience the unique beauty and wonder of this place. But they also make the journey to connect with one of Loxahatchee's most legendary and mysterious inhabitants. They visit the now abandoned camp that belonged to a man named Vincent Nelson, Trapper Nelson, the wild man of the Loxahatchee. Vincent Nacikowicz was born in 1908 to Polish immigrants in Trenton, New Jersey. As a boy, Vincent ran free and made money to help support his family by trapping small rodents, such as muskrats, in the New Jersey marshlands. Vincent's parents did not speak English, which meant he would often assist them in translating to make sure they weren't taken advantage of. His mother died during his early teens, and soon after, his father remarried, which left Vincent and his older stepbrother, Charlie, frustrated and unhappy. The two ran away to ride the rails as hobos. Now, the term hobo was common in the early 20th century, and a hobo wasn't the same thing as a tramp. A hobo was known as a traveling worker, unlike a tramp, which referenced men who worked only when they were forced to. And the brothers traveled west from New Jersey to Colorado and eventually ended up in Mexico, where the two were not welcomed. They were young, they were wild, and they were drifters, which meant people were suspicious of them. This led to the two young men being arrested on suspicion of gun running. Somehow, they were released, and Vincent and Charlie went directly to the closest train station and hopped a train back to the United States. Vincent would later say he had 10 cents to his name when he and Charlie re-entered the country. They gambled fellow hobos to make money for food and continued to ride the rails until 1931, when the brothers, along with a childhood friend, John Dykus, rode a boxcar across Florida's Loxahatchee River on a hot September day. The three men jumped off the train near Jupiter, Florida, on the southeastern coast of the state. The brothers felt drawn to the area and agreed they'd be staying here for a while. By the time they arrived in Jupiter, Vincent and his brother made the decision to make a fresh start with a new name. Vincent would later say it was simply a matter of having a last name that was hard to pronounce and deciding to make it easier on people. And that's how the brothers became known as Vincent and Charlie Nelson. The Nelsons, along with John Dykus, camped at what's now known as Jupiter Inlet Park and spent their days trapping and fishing. Trapping was big business, with northern furriers paying good money for pelts for their customers. The men hunted and trapped raccoons, possums, and other game with their friend John Dykus, and it wasn't pleasant work. but it was steady income until the income became an issue for John Dykus. Dykus didn't have the trapping skills of the Nelson brothers, but he began to demand that he be paid a third of any profit they received from wholesalers they were selling their pelts to. And the Nelson brothers, they just weren't having it. Dykus didn't work as hard, but he wanted more money. That just didn't add up to them. Tensions rose between the three, with Charlie and John fighting often. On December 17, 1931, a West Palm Beach constable was ordered to go to the camp where John Dykus and the Nelson brothers were trapping. He was ordered there to watch over a dead body until authorities could arrive and begin a murder investigation. Just hours before the constable arrived on scene, Charlie Nelson had driven to the West Palm Beach Police Department and told a desk sergeant that he had killed John Dykus. He calmly mentioned his shotgun was in the back seat of his car and told officers at the police station that they would find John Dykus back at his camp with a bullet right between his eyes. Charlie Nelson wrote his confession that day, and in it, he stated around 8:30 in the morning, Vince Nelson had gone off to check traps. Charlie sat down to eat breakfast at the campfire with John Dykus. Charlie told Dykus he was planning to head out on his own, hit the road again. John Dykus had become a de facto treasurer of the trapper's money and refused to give Charlie Nelson more than $50 of his share of the profits. Charlie told Dykus he had 15 minutes to hand over the money or he would be dead. John Dykus may have believed Charlie was drunk or just joking, or he may have just been a very stubborn man. He chose not to turn over the money, and Charlie Nelson picked up a shotgun and shot John Dykus between the eyes. In February 1932, a sensational trial began in West Palm Beach with Circuit Court Judge Curtis Chillingworth overseeing the case that had by now garnered attention across the state and in the Nelson brothers' home state of New Jersey. The most shocking part of the trial? Charlie Nelson entered a plea of not guilty, despite having written a confession. And the trial would pit brother against brother. Vince Nelson wasn't present when the murder occurred, but he did testify in the murder trial, testified for the prosecution, saying Charlie had told him he had indeed committed the murder as a result of a fight with Dykus, a fight over money. Charlie took the stand in his own defense. He broke down into tears as he shared what many said sounded like a rehearsed scene from a play. Charlie claimed John Dykus told him his brother Vince wanted him to leave, and Charlie finally agreed he should do that, but demanded his share of the money, which John Dykus refused to hand over. And Charlie Nelson said the next thing he knew, he heard a shot, and John Dykus was laying dead on the ground. He figured things looked bad for him, and that's why he went to the police and confessed. He felt trapped and didn't know what else to do. Well, the jury, they didn't believe Charlie's story. They found him guilty, but spared him the electric chair. On February 16, 1932, Judge Chillingworth sentenced Charlie Nelson to serve life in prison. Just after the sentence was handed down, Charlie Nelson turned around to face his brother Vince. He looked him straight in the eyes and vowed before everyone in the courtroom that day to kill Vince Nelson, and turned to Judge Chillingworth and vowed he'd kill him too. Vince Nelson's brother was in prison and he had helped send him there. One of Vince's best friends had been murdered by Charlie. Vince was alone. He did what many of us have tried to do. He tried to escape. Vince left Florida for a time and returned to his hometown of Trenton, New Jersey. He spent time working on a dairy farm, but found that that old adage of never really being able to go home again, it was true. He found himself longing to return to Florida and the tropical paradise he had there before the murder of John Dykus and his brother's imprisonment. By 1934, 25-year-old Vince Nelson returned to Florida and traveled a little further up the Loxahatchee River to a narrow bend that was impassable for motorboats. He decided this would be a great place to call home. He set up camp on high ground and borrowed money from his sister to buy a few acres of land and swamp. He planted fruit trees and built a hand-pumped irrigation system for a garden and continued his work as a trapper. Vince Nelson created his own private little world off the Loxahatchee. No one to limit him, just him and some very curious neighbors in the surrounding communities. Vince Nelson was always dressed in cutoff shorts, never wore a shirt, and made quite an impression when you saw him. He was 6'4", 240 pounds of pure muscle. He was hunting and trapping everything you could think of at the time. Gators, wildcats, raccoons, and snakes. Stories about what Vince Nelson was doing up the Loxahatchee started making their way around town. Stories of this wild man of the river jungle led to comparisons to Tarzan, with folks calling him the Wild Man of Loxahatchee. But Vince settled on another name, a rebirth of sorts. Vince became Trapper Nelson. Trapper liked life on his own, but after he settled his camp and began encountering his neighbors, he became known as a very pleasant man, fun to be around. According to Jan Davison's Cameos of Florida History, the respected Dubois family, Bessie and her husband John, ran a fishing camp near the mouth of the Loxahatchee and became friends with Trapper. They had him over for dinner all the time, and Bessie said she learned early on that she always needed to make extra food. One night, Bessie brought dessert out for everyone, a big old lemon meringue pie. One of the guests they had over that night cut a very tiny piece of the pie. He passed the knife to Trapper, who dug in and finished off the entire pie. Another reminder that Trapper did things the Trapper way. And he was a constant contradiction. Trapper loved his isolated life, but when he'd socialize, he was fun. Except for one issue that haunted him no matter where he went. His aroma. Bessie Dubois noted in her book, The History of Loxahatchee, Trapper caught and skinned so many raccoons, wildcats, and other game that even though he bathed every day, when dogs got downwind of him, they would catch the scent of those animals and bark themselves hoarse, which embarrassed Trapper and the dog owners. The curiosity about Trapper Nelson continued to grow to the point that local jungle cruise boats started stopping at Trapper's dock. He'd show visitors the alligators around the place and his snake pit that one visitor described as being like something straight out of a nightmare. Venomous rattlesnakes that Trapper Nelson would simply lean down and snatch behind the jaw as he picked them up to the amazement of his guest. Trapper continued to trap wildlife that would be traded to zoos across the country. James Snyder shared in his book, Life and Death on the Loxahatchee, the trapper once dropped off a cage at a local rail station. The cage held a black panther, so you can imagine the surprise on the part of the rail station worker who read instructions on the side of the cage. The instructions simply said, headed to a zoo in New York, he's a mean cat, so don't pester him. Whatever was wild and caused others to feel fear, well, those things made Trapper Nelson tick. It was his passion. And by 1938, Trapper Nelson figured if people were going to come see him and his camp, he should be making some money out of the deal. He made a sign that read, Trapper Nelson Zoo and Jungle Garden, a sign that's out on his property to this day. Trapper began charging the boats to dock. Admission was 50 cents for adults and 25 cents for children. And those children were simultaneously terrified and fascinated by this enormous man who greeted them at the dock. And the manner in which he greeted them was shocking and entertaining. As visitors would arrive at the camp, Trapper Nelson greeted them on the docks with a large black indigo snake draped around his neck. And sometimes he would shake hands with the kids, and that black snake would slither down his arm onto the arm of the child. Trapper always thought it was funny, and some kids agreed. Others would be frozen until Trapper removed his old friend, the snake. After greeting his guest, he'd make sure they knew all he had to offer, including his wildlife displays. Visitors could enjoy their lunch at the picnic tables, then gaze in awe at Trapper's alligator den and rattlesnake pit. They were fascinated by Trapper Nelson and the wild world he had created on the shore of the Loxahatchee, especially the ladies. Trapper Nelson was a very good-looking man who was the main attraction for many of the women who visited his camp and dreamed of being the wild woman of Loxahatchee. He enjoyed the attention and, of course, the income that came with those curious tourists. An interest in Trapper Nelson Zoo expanded beyond the immediate community. Trapper Nelson Zoo and camp and the growing private club of the Jupiter Island community were on opposite sides of the Loxahatchee River. In between these areas was Jupiter, Florida, with families facing hard times during the Depression era. They were making a living off fishing, farming, and trading goods. As James Snyder points out in Life and Death on the Loxahatchee, Jupiter Island was becoming its own unique community for the wealthy, with movie stars and celebrities from all walks of life visiting the area. Trapper Nelson Zoo and camp seemed to be the equalizer for these communities. They were all curious about this wild man who had created his own world apart from Jupiter and Jupiter Island, a place that was his, and people from all walks of life were drawn to his place. Families, teens who would skip school to go on adventures out to see the wild man of Loxahatchee, and those movie stars. Well, they were socializing with men like Joseph Reed, who had the idea to organize tours for those stars and made arrangements for them to go to Trapper Nelson Zoo for a wild experience. And they loved it so much that they would come back, organize their own tours to go back and see Trapper Nelson. Over the years, Katharine Hepburn, Gary Cooper, the DuPonts, and even the Kennedys visited Trapper and toured a zoo. He'd finish off a tour by letting them watch him wrestle alligators. Yep, Trapper loved to wrestle the gators because he knew it made for a really great show. And he loved growing his business. Along with his camp, zoo, and his trapping and trade business, Trapper was buying up land. His friends always pointed out that he was a wild man to tourists, but the man behind the gators and the snakes was smart, and he knew a good deal when he saw it. Trapper subscribed to the Wall Street Journal and would read of the fast rising value of land in and around Jupiter Island. Over time, he purchased over 1,100 acres of land along the upper Loxahatchee River, including 800 acres of now prized Jupiter land. Trapper's business was flying high. He was one of the most popular tourist attractions in the area. But nothing can last forever. Things changed for Jupiter and for Trapper and the world with the growing threat of America entering World War II. The Selective Service and draft system had been established in America in 1940. World War II had been raging since 1939, and America had remained formally neutral. But as time went on, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt warned that entering the conflict would be unavoidable. With that knowledge and a desire to avoid the draft, Trapper Nelson decided it was time to get married. This was a common practice for men who believed marriage would protect them from being called up to serve. In an attempt to gain an exemption, Trapper Nelson married Lucille Gee in 1940. But his rumored affairs with wealthy women who were visiting his camp led to his wife leaving him for another man she had been having an affair with. Despite his attempt to avoid the draft, Trapper Nelson was called to serve after the Pearl Harbor attack of December 7, 1941, when America officially entered the war. By 1942, Trapper Nelson was in Texas for boot camp. During training, he suffered a leg injury that led to Trapper being transferred back to Jupiter, Florida, to Camp Murphy. His knowledge of the area wildlife, it came in handy. His work included efforts to keep dangerous animal populations under control and keep soldiers safe. And as an MP, he guarded the camp's perimeter, which allowed him to access his property and hunt for days at a time. Trapper Nelson would serve until World War II ended in 1945. He then returned to his camp and to his life of entertaining visitors at his zoo. The population of Jupiter grew after World War II, which meant people had good jobs and they had money to spend on things like boat rides out to see the wild man of Loxahatchee wrestle gators and occasionally run into celebrities who were there to see Trapper's show. The growth had meant more money for Trapper Nelson, but as time passed, the growth would mean more complications. Around 1950, the population of Jupiter was roughly 300 people, but over the course of the next decade, the population would increase to over 1,200. That growth led to many changes for Trapper and his camp. The tourists that had come to see him in the past would take a 10-mile journey downriver that would take them hours. But the development of land that once separated Trapper's camp from Jupiter meant a journey that had taken hours was reduced to about 15 minutes by car on new roads that had been developed. Trapper Nelson had built a life along the shore of the Loxahatchee, a life he allowed people to enter and then leave. But as time passed and development increased, the people were moving closer and closer to him. And all the land he had purchased, well, that land meant taxes, and the tax values continued to increase, which increased Trapper's financial burden. Developers were doing all they could to drive him off of his highly valued waterfront property. They wanted him to sell, but Trapper Nelson refused. And development wasn't his only problem. The growth of the Jupiter area also meant more regulations and inspections. Inspectors started visiting his camp and demanding improvements to animals' living conditions and demanded the structures on his camp be brought up to code. The wild man of Loxahatchee didn't feel so wild and free anymore. His next move surprised people. In August of 1960, Trapper Nelson dropped a large tree across the river just up from his property. That move prevented motorboats from reaching him. He then blocked his gate on the new dirt road that accessed his property. Trapper Nelson's Jungle Zoo was officially closed, and Trapper Nelson returned to a life of seclusion and revealed a side of himself to his family that had never been revealed in the past. Fear. The wild man of Loxahatchee, who wrestled gators and calmly picked up rattlesnakes while an audience watched, was fearful of all the changes happening around him and unsure of his future. In a September 1960 letter to his brother-in-law, Trapper wrote the following: "Have closed my camp to all the public, including the crews. Now I feel a lot safer, as it was a real risk in many ways dealing with the public." Trapper had also shut out most of his friends around Jupiter, all except John Dubois. Trapper confided to John that he had been experiencing stomach pains for a long time and had convinced himself he had colon cancer. John was concerned and told Trapper he needed to see a doctor, but Trapper just didn't trust them, hardly trusted anyone anymore. Over the next 7 years, Trapper Nelson would continue to withdraw from any contact with friends of the past. In May of 1968, Trapper seemed to offer a little hope to his family back in Trenton, New Jersey, that his fears were being alleviated and he was accepting the development in the area. That month, he wrote a letter to his sister and her husband mentioning, "The state park is now definitely taking steps to make me an offer on my ranch." Which was true. Trapper Nelson had been negotiating a deal that would allow him to stay on his property until his death and preserve his acreage as a protected state park. That deal would have made Trapper Nelson a millionaire. A couple of months later, in July of 1968, Trapper's Jeep needed some repairs. He dropped it off at a service station. The next day, the shop's owner drove the Jeep to Trapper's property. When he parked it, he saw Trapper walk by, and they waved at each other. Trapper never said a word, and that was the last time Trapper Nelson was seen alive. On July 30th, 1968, there was supposed to be a gathering at the Dubois fishing camp. Some of Trapper's old friends had finally gotten him to agree to come see them. As time passed, Trapper didn't show up. And his old friend John decided to go to Trapper's camp to see if he could convince him to come and see his friends. When John arrived, he found 59-year-old Trapper Nelson lying dead on the ground under his tiki hut, a gunshot to his stomach, his shotgun a few feet away from him on the ground. John said it was obvious Chopper had been dead for a few days. Authorities officially ruled the death of Trapper Nelson a suicide. But to this day, there are people who believe Trapper Nelson was murdered, would never have killed himself when he was on the brink of becoming a millionaire. There are several murder theories. Some believe he was murdered by trespassers he was said to have shot at after he shut down the zoo. There had also been rumors that he had money buried all over his campground, and people around the community believe someone had gone out to Trapper's place to try to get that money, and Trapper died trying to stop them. But authorities said there was no sign of a struggle near the area where Trapper Nelson's body was found. And the biggest rumor and theory as to who could have killed Trapper Nelson was the rumor that his brother, Charlie, may have followed through on his promise to track him down. Trapper had told friends through the years that he wondered if Charlie would ever find him and kill him. Remember, Charlie had murdered a man and threatened to kill his own brother. The Florida Department of Corrections released Charlie Nelson from prison on November 20th, 1951. But the investigation into Trapper Nelson's death was closed before anyone made an attempt to locate Charlie. 2018 marked the 50th anniversary of the passing of Trapper Nelson. With the passage of time, stories of his life and death have been printed in newspapers. And every time the story comes up, it fuels the murder theory. Trapper Nelson's family has made it very clear they don't believe he was murdered. In September 2018, the Palm Beach Post shared that Cindy Tomasetti had emailed reporter Elliot Kleinberg. She requested that some facts that the paper and many other outlets had shared about Trapper's life be cleared up once and for all. Tomasetti is the grandniece of Trapper Nelson. Tomasetti wanted to go on record on behalf of her family that no one in the family ever suspected foul play in her uncle Vince's death. Kleinberg shared Tomasetti's clarifications and reached out to Josh Liller, the historian and collections manager for the Loxahatchee River Historical Society. The reporter wanted to know if there were any other details about the life of Trapper Nelson that needed to be updated. Liller asked that there be clarification that to this day, there's no evidence Trapper Nelson ever shot at trespassers. He did have a run-in or two with local teens who harassed him on a few occasions. And he did get angry at people who showed up at his property uninvited after he had shut down the zoo, but shots were never fired. As to Trapper Nelson's death, Liller stated that the lengthy transcript of the coroner's jury makes a very strong case for suicide, perhaps even an accident. What it comes down to is that the murder theory lacks any support and evidence. As Liller put it, there were no suspects connected by more than circumstantial evidence, even after 50 years. The murder theory has survived this long because of misreporting many years ago. On August 6, 1968, Trapper Nelson's family and a few friends scattered his ashes into the waters of the Loxahatchee River. After Trapper Nelson's death, a deal was finalized with the state and Trapper's family. The state acquired the land along the upper Loxahatchee River and ensured the land would be protected from development and secured in its natural state. That's how the area became a national wild and scenic river, protected for all time. Trapper Nelson's camp has been part of Jonathan Dickinson State Park since 1970. Tourists still travel downstream to visit Trapper's place, where Camp Ranger explains the camp's history and the legendary life of the man who once called this land home. And some folks along the Loxahatchee say if you're willing to wait until darkness falls over the river, you could have the same experience some tour guides and some neighbors have had around Trapper's place. Maybe you'll see what they've seen, the shadow of a large man towering over you, inspecting his camp and maybe you'll see the shadow of that infamous black snake wrapped around his neck. Welcoming you to Trapper Nelson Zoo and Jungle Garden. Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. To learn more about the life of Trapper Nelson and see photos of him, view the show notes for this episode at southernmysteries.com. If you enjoyed hearing about Trapper Nelson and you want to hear more episodes of the podcast, make sure you're subscribed to Southern Mysteries so you never miss an episode. And I'd appreciate it if you considered listening to Southern Mysteries on the Radio Public app. It's free, available on iOS or Android, easy to use, and helps listeners like you and me find and support shows like Southern Mysteries. When you listen to Southern Mysteries on Radio Public, everyone benefits because I get paid when you listen, and the money helps pay for the hosting fees associated with producing this podcast. It's free to listen, but it's not free to create a podcast like Southern Mysteries. So it would mean a lot to me if you supported the show by listening with the Radio Public app. Thanks for listening.